This morning, the title they've given, or I gave it actually, I won't say they, I gave it. It's funny, you choose the titles and then you get there and you think, so now how does this fit? But it's the, we're fearfully and wonderfully made. And I think I'm feeling the kind of, there's a tension between almost two parallel things that I feel like the Spirit is wanting to say. One is to really draw down and to get a sense of the, of just actually how intimately involved He is and wants to be in our lives. And then on the flip side is more, if you like, for who you are as a church, which is what does it mean? How should we behave, therefore, in the current season, in the current age, and what is God's priorities for us prophetically? So some of it is personal and some is corporate, and the two kind of going on together. So I'm trying to work out how they interrelate and interplay. So I'm just going to read the words from Psalm 139, where that wonderful line is taken. It says, you know, you formed my inner parts and you wove me together in my mother's womb. So I'm going to give thanks because I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. And, you know, the first thing just to notice from this is that it's not a kind of a case of somehow we arrive struggling on the earth and somehow at some point we do something and God notices us. But actually that before we had absolutely anything more than just a bit of kind of gluey DNA, that God was actually intimately involved from the womb. And as I was saying last night, part of the reason sometimes we find that hard to understand is because so much bad happens even before people are born. And so people from the womb have experienced evil, and we'll think about that in a minute. But here it's saying that actually from that moment, God was involved. And he was, so it says, I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. And my soul knows it well. Remember that we said if we can't acknowledge God and give him thanks, we get handed over, it says in Romans, to our darkened understanding. But actually there's a battle sometimes to see and acknowledge God when we've been born into conflict. We'll think a little bit about that this morning. So my frame wasn't hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth. Your eyes have seen my unformed substance. And then this line, and in your book they were written, the days you've laid out for me, when as yet there were none of them. And I'm not a believer, if you like, in God's blueprint plan. In other words, that absolutely everything that happens to you. But it doesn't say that here. It just says that you understood, you knew my days. The days that I had were laid out for me. In other words, God looks at the child forming. So like, is that Harvey? Yeah, that's right, like little Harvey. He's the one who's gone through his experience most recently, so we can pick on him. As he's being put together, and God is involved there. And however you want to see it, whether it's at the level of chemistry and DNA, he sees the gifts that are going into Harvey. He's involved with them. He knows the days and the seasons and the years he's being born into. He understands, therefore, the life that's coming. And he starts within that context to have a dream for Harvey. He starts to have a purpose and a plan. And says, I know what you can do. I know how you can fit in. I know how you can be the best you can be. I know who you can be before me. All of that is going on just as the life is being put together in the womb. And then it goes on and says, so how precious are your thoughts to me, O God? How vast is the sum of them? If I could count them, they would outnumber the sand. And when I wake up, I'm still with you. This is almost like, I'm kind of, when I'm in a dream, this is the way I see it. But when I wake up, reality is no different. Actually, it is true. And I love that little phrase, you know, that your thoughts are like, they're unnumberable. Because, that's right, I started to say this last night, but I'm afraid I was a little bit spaced out last night, so I didn't quite finish the thread. But, that, you know, when you journal, you know, you can write a journal page each day of your life. And, you know, so 365 days in a year, so, and then you live maybe 70 years, so what's that? About 2,500. Yeah. No, it's about 28,000, I think. Something like that. Yeah, I know, but I'm just saying in an average life, it's going to be something like 28,000. That's not innumerable. We can easily count up to that. Okay, you know, so why is it innumerable? Partly the reason why it's innumerable is because there are all sorts of things that happen in life, and so God's plan for us has to take into account all the bad possibilities as well as the things he would like to have happen. And supposing that happens, well, if that happens, we have to change the plan. We have to, and so because of that, because God has actually taken account of all of those possibilities, all those things that come against us, And so I wanted to kind of get this sense of we this incredible love of a good God who actually has purpose for us that we can fit into, even though there are things that happen to us that were not part of his plan, and that we can know that place of security. But I want to say, you see, I think it is the hope of the world is for us to actually find that purpose. If there is need in the world, it is because someone has not fitted into their plan. And the funny thing is, I don't necessarily fix anything by responding straight away to the need and therefore abandoning my plan. Does that make sense? So God's made me to do this, but I see over here a need because somebody else is not doing what they were made to do. So what I do is I turn and I chase over after here to fill the obvious need, and I leave another one behind me. And that's actually what the world does. It ends up chasing its tail. Chasing its tail. So I leave my post to go and fill yours, and somebody has to fill mine, and we're all, none of us, doing quite what we're best for, best fitted for, what there is grace for, what there is blessing and anointing for. And so you see that tension in Jesus. So when one day he says he set his face towards Jerusalem, he knows he's going there to die. And en route, a Syrophoenician woman comes to him. And she has a problem. Her daughter is unwell. And it's interesting because we know how much Jesus loves to heal and how he went about destroying the works of the evil one. And yet when she asks, he hesitates. And he says, but I'm called to the children of Israel. See, can you see the tension that's going on in him? Which is, you don't abandon your calling just because there's an immediate need, because otherwise we can end up leaving what we're supposed to do and we leave a bigger need here. If I get distracted from what I'm called to do, which is to go and die in Jerusalem, I might do something good today, but I leave a bigger problem for eternity. Now, in the end, Jesus actually does, of course, heal the child. But you see in the dialogue almost with the Holy Spirit that's going on, which is, how do I fill need? And when need presents to us, I don't advocate we don't do anything about it, because the point is he does. But what I suppose I'm driving at is, we don't allow our sense of calling to be dictated because there is need, you see. And we actually need to, our calling comes out of our calling. That's what God gives and asks us to do. And if more of us lived that way, there would actually be less need. See, so that's the strange thing. If we did what we were supposed to do, we would find in the end more of the gaps got filled and less there would be less need around. And so I want to say something about the plan God has for us, and how we are conflicted in it and how we find our way back into it. But you see, as I said yesterday, the world is really, it's desperate for there to be a sense of something I should join into, something that gives me meaning rather than meaning I have to find for myself. It's an incredibly restful place to be. I sometimes wonder about all of that, all of the language in the Bible about rest and unrest. In many ways, is that, am I satisfied and happy in life because I know my value in him? Or am I desperately unhappy and so I'm trying to find that rest, find that peace? And it just is very elusive. It gets away from us. So it says here that your days were laid out for me. And it's just fascinating because I see in Jesus, and I wrote this up in the second of my Supernatural Life book, Supernatural Hope. There's a kind of a pattern in Jesus, and here's the pattern for every life. And the pattern you find, strangely, is hidden in the names of Jesus' ancestors. So we mentioned yesterday God, and we mentioned Adam, but if you go on, the ancestors' names come on out. The Seth is the next one, which means to be appointed, and Enosh, which then means to be mortal, or failing is what it means. And then the next bit, the next name is Kenan, which could be the same name as Cain, which would mean it means begotten, not got hold of, begotten. Or I prefer Kenan is a Hebrew word, which means it's a lament, it's sorrowful. I mean, it's sorrowful. So straight away in those first few names, you see the beginning of Jesus' life, because he's God, a builder. So remember, I said Adam could be a producer or a maker, a builder. God, a builder, is appointed as mortal and sorrowful. See? Now, Jesus was a tecton, which we sometimes think of as a carpenter, but the Greek word tecton just more normally means a builder. Jesus' father was also a tecton, i.e. a builder, so he moved to Nazareth in about 3 BC. Why did he move to Nazareth in 3 BC? Well, because 3 miles north of Nazareth in 3 BC The Romans started work on what would become the biggest building project in the Middle East in Jesus' lifetime. It was the new capital, the new Roman capital of Galilee, which is called the town of Sepphoris or Zephora, if you're Hebrew. And it was a city set on a hill that looked down over the whole Galilean kind of basin. And it's 3 miles north of where Joseph moved at the same year that he moved there. There's a reason why he went there as a builder, because there was a lot of building work starting there. And so Jesus really was this builder that God has appointed to be mortal. He was born under, if you like, a sentence of death and unsorrowful. And so Jesus is born into a world that is dying. And not only that, but actually there's a lot of pain. And so he is born in a little village, and his dad has gone there because it's his family village. And archaeology tells us that it only had a handful of people living in Bethlehem at the time. And yet Herod comes and kills all the babies under two, which is probably about 6 babies. So which is why history doesn't make a note of it, because it's not enormous. That's why it doesn't really rate in terms of the bad things that Herod did. So sometimes historians kind of say they don't think it's true because why don't we record it anywhere else? Well, because when you're a dictator like Herod, the killing of 6 kids in a village somewhere is not a big crime. So it doesn't. But the point is, they were probably Jesus' relatives, because everyone's interrelated in a small village like that. So Jesus is born knowing that his birth caused the death of his own relatives. It's tough, isn't it? It's not a nice thing to happen. And he, as a young man growing up 3 miles south of Sepphoris, in his early teens, when he had just started working perhaps as a builder with his father on this town, a man called Judah the Galilean led a rebellion from that same town. And so in punishment, the Romans took 2,000 men of working age, which Jesus would have just entered into that period, and crucified them down the road to Passover. So people that Jesus would have worked with, maybe he grew up with, understood and knew, have been murdered by the occupying force. And Jesus walks down the road to Jerusalem to Passover with 2,000 of people he knew. So he is born into death and sorrow. So it's not dissimilar. His life is not different to each of ours. Now we've been relatively fortunate. There are plenty of people in the world who have been born into situations far more like Jesus was born into. If they're in places, Syria and parts of Africa, we're talking about Congo, where in actual fact they are born into that conflict of unfair death. And yet something in the spirit of Jesus never lets the wrong that is going on in the world shape who he is. And so that actually when he starts preaching and he says, when the Romans ask you to go 1 mile, why don't you go the other? Those same Romans that crucified my own countrymen, under whose jurisdiction, under Herod, even my own relatives were being killed. There's something quite powerful when you understand it's not sort of some blasé kind of easy statement. Part of the trouble is sometimes we reread the Gospels from what has been a relatively comfortable situation in the West. And one of the things I sometimes say is to understand, one of the things that sometimes worries me about the UK church is how easily we talk about forgiveness. See, forgiveness is a very powerful thing, but it's not an easy thing. It's only easy for us because we've often sat with every privilege in life, and so it's easy to be gracious to someone who's less privileged than me. Does that make sense? That's actually a relatively easy thing to do. It's much harder when you've been at the bottom of the pile and somebody who's had every advantage over you still needs to be forgiven. That's a much harder thing. So there's this first phase. So the days that you knew, the days you've seen laid out for me, as God looks over his son's life, he sees the days that are laid out for him, and he knows that the beginning starts with, God, this builder is appointed mortal and sorrowful. And then the next phrase is, Mahalel is the next name in Jesus' ancestry, which means the glory of God. So Mahalel, the glory of God. Jared means comes down or descends. See, it's beginning to sound a bit like Jesus' life, isn't it? The glory of God comes down. And Enoch, which means to dedicate, or if it's used as a noun, it's someone who's a teacher. So to dedicate, or a teacher, which is Enoch. And then Enoch's son was called Methuselah, okay, which means his death shall bring. And then the next person in that line is called Lamech, which seems to, the old dictionaries would say it was kind of a wild man, but the idea is because it means to go low. And so they thought, well, because if you go low, it's because you're a bit wild. But it can mean, you could think of it as depraved or as humble. Because both of those are about going low. I am humble, or I'm just wallowing in the muck. And so either of those. And then Noah, rest. So you put them all together and you get this, you actually get, if you like, almost the sense of God's plan for his son. God, a builder, is appointed, is mortal and sorrowful. But the glory of God descends to dedicate a teacher. His death shall bring the depraved or the humble rest. And I see in it the pattern for every human life. Because Jesus, if you like, is the arch-human. He's the human that represents and stands for everybody. Which is, we are all born into a world that's got the sentence of death on it, and which actually is sorrowful. It's full of bad things. And yet somehow in that, we can still be, and this is where the first spiritual battle is, the first spiritual battle is to still be a producer or a builder. You know, it's the same word, Adamu, which means to produce or to make or build. Is to find what is my natural productivity. Because that was the first thing that got lost in the fall, do you remember? So with fruitfulness, the productivity gets lost. And so the first part, if you like, the first challenge, because each phase of God's plan has something that comes against us, and we have to therefore overcome. So we read about the overcomers in Revelation, who overcame by the blood of the Lamb and the word of their story, the word of their testimony. So they had a story that shows how they overcame the adversity. Because actually we overcome the adversity by the blood of the Lamb. So in one sense it's all part of the same thing. But it's incredible when you stop and think about it that what God is saying is that I beat the devil as much through your story as through the blood of Jesus. Even though, of course, my story includes the blood of Jesus. Actually, he's honored us by putting our story into that same event, that same victory. That makes sense. And so here is so each phase has this adversity we have to overcome. And the first basic one is to stay productive, to stay fruitful in the face of the injustice and the death that surrounds us. And it's a really big one, because here's the interesting thing. So it says that God makes man a producer, and yet in the modern world, everybody is not defined as a producer. We're defined as what? As consumers. Okay. And that is always tension, because the thing is, to be human, you have to consume. You have to eat. You have to eat. The problem isn't that you eat. It's the problem is when you eat more than you produce. Yeah? If you produce more than you eat, then life is happy. You know, it's a bit like in Dickens's Great Expectations. Which one is it? No. Mr. Micawber is in Great Expectations, isn't he? I think, you know, he makes that statement about, you know, what's the difference between a happy life and an unhappy life. And the happy life is income of kind of 3 shillings and 1 penny. And expenditure of just 3 shillings, and an unhappy life is the opposite way around. You know, I earn 3 shillings, but I spend 3 shillings and a penny. It's that tiny little difference between how much you consume and how much you produce makes the difference. And so God has made us to be, if you like, to produce more than we consume. And yet we live in a modern world. This is what I'm saying. This is now touching the, what does it mean to be a church, as opposed to, and we'll come back in a minute, so what does it mean for me as an individual? But as a church, it is something of our mission is to actually help people to become more productive in life. It's not a political statement. It's a spiritual statement, because we are happier when life is fruitful. People are desperately unhappy when it's all consumption, consumption, consumption. And yet here's the strange thing. Unless you earn, in the UK, over £48,000 a year, that's what figure I read a couple of years ago. Unless you earn over £48,000 a year, you will always be consuming more than you produce. Okay? You hear that? So that means pretty much everybody, okay, in the UK is consuming more in terms of resources and so on than they produce, which is why the nation has this enormous debt. Because we have had political leaders who, rather than address it, have just gone on kind of borrowing to feed it. Now, I blame nobody, because I'm in the same thing. We are born into a situation that, because that's what the devil wants us to be. He keeps us unproductive. Or he keeps us in that place where we eat more than we can produce. Now, when you're a child, it's fine to eat more than you produce. Okay? Of course, when you're a baby, you're supposed to. But it is part of our growing to maturity that the things get turned over. And so it is something about how we as a church, we actually help make people's lives more fruitful, more productive. Not out of some political statement of kind of, you know, forcing people back to work or things like that. I just mean because it's good for life. Why? Because people weren't made to be primarily consumers all their lives. They weren't. God's plan for everybody was that you should be productive. Every life should be fruitful. And so a part of our role as a church is often helping people see, oh, I've got real skill here. And with this skill, I can do something with it. Now, because of the vast amounts of debt the nation owes, it may never be that we get fully to that place. But if we all step up a bit, life becomes a little bit more productive. And so, so there is and you see, there's part of it is about the inner heart and the inner life. We read about David, it was, who wrote Psalm 139, and which is about being fearfully and wonderfully made. But David also wrote Psalm 51. I go to Psalm 51. You see a different, slightly different perspective of being in the womb. He says, "I was birthed in iniquity. And in sin, my mother," it doesn't actually say conceived, it says she warmed me up, like she incubated me. I was being gestated in sin. And it says, "But you desire truth in the inner being. In the hidden parts, you will make me know wisdom." And then it goes, "Purify me with hyssop." So what he was saying is that actually, even as I'm being born, even when I'm in the womb, that battle is going on. Sin is trying to push its way in. And it's God's job to purify me and clean me, because at that stage there's very little I can do about it. And it's just one of those sad things that we now increasingly know that in the womb we're already being infected by pain and sorrow in the world. And so strife in our environment actually gets into the child's psyche. And bad nutrition means that the DNA can be perfect, but the way the body is built doesn't get built perfectly. And all of these layers on layers. So even as the little child is being formed and shaped, there is this battle going on that they have to overcome. And so it's not their fault. But it is our responsibility, or part of our job, to help the child overcome what's come against them. To find a way of breaking through, to whether it's forgiveness against those that hurt them, to find a place where they are not so shaped by the need for revenge and so on and so forth. And that somehow the inner life, and then it goes on, it says, "But you desire truth in my inner life." To get truth into the inner life. And for it to come and settle. And it does make a difference. About just over a year ago, I think it was now, the leading journal for sociologists around the world, I can't remember what the journal is called, published the results of quite a number of years' worth of research. And the article started like this. It said, "As much as I've tried to pick flaws or to find holes in this argument, I cannot. It is now incontrovertible that the number one factor for determining whether a community experiences measures of kind of well-being, i.e. they're doing well, is the presence in the generation before of conversionary missionaries." So this is a secular top sociologist magazine writing up a report on some research that had been funded in the end by the Templeton Institute. They put $50 million into this research. And because about 30 years ago, a young Christian sociologist had decided to do as his PhD project a paper on the effects of missionaries in some part of South America where he'd worked, and had been surprised at what a massive difference they had made. He had been shocked, even though he was a Christian. And he'd gone around with his PhD thesis for 30 years to various conferences, running it as a little seminar, and never any interest, nobody wanted to hear. So one day he was doing it, and there was someone there from the Templeton Institute who came up and said, "We have $50 million and that has been raised to research a project like you've just talked about." So they sent people all over the world to every different missionary context, and they explored what went on, even two different villages. And they found that always it was the case, and it wasn't if there were cultural missionaries or if there were missionaries who kind of were coming in with social care and action. It was conversionary, so they use that phrase, conversionary missionaries. Missionaries who came in to convert people to Jesus Christ. When they were there, a generation later, more of the women read, there was better social kind of mobility, there was better sanitation, there was a higher degrees of literacy, all these things that people measure quality of life on were better a generation after conversionary missionaries had been in. Which was a lovely, lovely scientific proof, if you like, of that verse that says righteousness uplifts a nation. The gospel is good for the world. And even before that, it had been recognized, quite to the huge embarrassment of the secular world, that no other force is less than 1% of the impact in terms of global literacy. It is almost all due to the gospel. The world can read today because of the gospel. And most of the world's languages didn't even have a written form until missionaries came along, and to try and get across the gospel, they actually codified the languages, turned them into, therefore, ones that you could write down. And the first things that ever got written and the first things that ever got taught to people to read was the Bible. So that's this enormous base layer. And then you get on top of this all of the schools that got sent all over the world, and so on and so forth. You add all of these factors up, and there's no other reason why the world reads today. There's never been any other program to teach the world to read other than the gospel. See, so what's happening? Can you see how when the gospel gets in, that battle is being won? That the first phase of life, which is I was made to be a fruitful builder, but I was born under mortality and sorrow into a sorrowful world, and yet somehow I'm still successful in what he's made me. You see, and where the gospel goes out, that does better. And so we, you know, obviously then there's that place then as we go further. But this morning I just want to focus on that first phase of how when the glory of God descends, it allows us to teach others to pass that on. It's by the Spirit that victory that we've got, we can pass on. And actually there's something as well which we can leave a legacy. And in the book, I kind of take that people through that huge amounts of the world's institutions that benefit mankind are the legacy of people who walked with a promise from God. They left something beyond their own life. And so there is something that I think that is part of where the Lord wants the church to rediscover, which is their calling to put value back into people, or to put fruitfulness back, to help people win. Even if they don't transition into the spiritual phases of life, it is God's intention that everybody should be fruitful. You know, it is our rejection of God that actually puts us in a place where things are unfruitful. And if we will just kind of somehow turn around and start to face him again, we suddenly find there's a grace over the things we do. And so in the years that are ahead of us, it's not a kind of, as I say, a Daily Mail headline. It's just a statement of truth, which is they are going to be very difficult times. They're going to be very difficult times. And often people don't like you saying that in church. But there's a time where the disciples are saying, "Isn't the temple amazing?" And Jesus says, "Yeah, but you know it's not going to be like that forever." And they said, "What do you mean?" And he says, "Well, I'm going to tell you about some days that are coming that are really tough." And then he says, "But when you see these things happening, this is what you should do." And I think there's something that the Lord wants to say for us, the church, to understand that because of the things that are going on globally, the years that are ahead of us are not going to be like the years we've had behind us. And if I can put it in these ways, is, you know, one of the things which you've got a remarkable favour in, and it is God's favour, it's not something else, has been the cooperation of the civic authorities. And I know lots of churches have done very well in those kinds of ways, but in actual fact, what we're going to find is that their ability to be any use is going to diminish, because they won't be able to be It's, in other words, that season is almost one of those things that's coming to an end. And in actual fact, it's the other way around, which is the way it was in the beginning, if I can put it. If you look at what happens when the gospel gets hold of a nation, it's not that the nation is so wealthy that it can help the church. It is actually that the church does so well that it shapes the nation. Okay? And you see, we've got used to living in a nation that had every blessing because so many people of faith walked out and released blessing for everybody, because by grace the sun shines on the unrighteous and the righteous alike. I love that verse because there's also a verse that says that God makes the rain to come on the righteous and the unrighteous alike. You know, because actually both of them can be a blessing, can't they? See? They're both blessings at different times. So the rain comes on the righteous and the unrighteous, and the sun shines on the righteous and the unrighteous. It's both true. So I worked for a season, because I used to work with computers, I worked for Lloyd's Bank. And Samuel Lloyd was a deeply devout believer who set up his bank because the Bank of England wasn't loaning to average people. And his own family story was that his great-great-great-grandfather was an alcoholic in prison who got saved through the Quakers, and they helped him, and he managed to turn his life around, and gradually each generation the family was doing better and better. Now they'd done really well, and Samuel Lloyd looked around and saw nobody else could do what his family had done because no one would lend to them to get them out of trouble. So there's a difference between lending and getting someone into debt. See, if you're lending, it's to actually help someone out of a situation. Keeping them in debt is about making all of their life come towards you. They have to work and work and work just to keep servicing you. It's the difference. So he started his bank to help people get out of the situations their lives were trapped in. It was like today's modern microfinance in Africa. You know, the way microfinance works, you give someone a small loan, they buy an oven or something, and they start cooking bread, and a generation later they don't need to be borrowing because they're productive and fruitful. So that's what he was doing. So that's Lloyd's Bank. And if you go to the Houses of Parliament, on the floor it says, unless the Lord builds a house, those who labour in vain. And actually all our political institutions were founded by people with faith and out of their walk with. And so we are actually coming into a season again where what has happened is we have squandered the legacy that was left to us in Western Europe by our believing great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandparents who did these remarkable things, whether it was in the Salvation Army, whether it was Dr. Bernardo's, whether it's all of these things, and you find faith in the heart of them. And that somehow there was a grace that made people fruitful. And that is not just true here, but it happens in villages in the middle of nowhere. And this is what the Templeton Institute showed, that conversionary missionaries produce an effect that uplifts community. So in our micro ways, we may not be able to change the world around us, but we can in our towns do things which become more fruitful, which is a blessing to everybody. Yeah, there's that lovely story, isn't it, where the 10 lepers come and Jesus heals them all. And they all go and only one of them is grateful. And that's just the way it goes. We do what we do and release blessing of God into a community, and 1 in 10 might be grateful. But that's still good for everybody. It's still good for everybody. That the gospel has been good news even for those who didn't want it. That's the strange thing. We kind of have tended, in our narrow way, we think it's only good news because someone receives it. Otherwise it's a bit bad news, you know. But actual fact, in real terms, it's good news for everybody. Because it produces this greater sense of fairness and so on. And so I just want to come back because I don't want to. There's no clock in this room, so that's one of my excuse. You see, I don't know. Got half an hour yet. That's good. Which is that thing of, okay, so who has the Lord made me to be? And what have been the challenges in my life? Because as we start to see more clearly how the enemy has come against us to try and rob our fruitfulness, we also then start to understand what our testimony is. Because as we overcome the obstacles he's put in front of us being fruitful, the bad things that have happened to us, the things that have been unfair, the things that have robbed us of our opportunities and so on, as we start to become aware of how we are overcoming those things, then we have a testimony. You see, your testimony is not just how did I get saved. Your testimony is how has Jesus led me? How has he shaped my life to this point? How has he taken me forward? And it's in the telling of that testimony that we actually find he is undermined and his authority starts to disappear. As I sit down and say, you know, your story is quite like mine, let me tell you my story. See, that telling of that story, that testimony, starts to win others too. As others kind of go, oh, okay, I can see. I can see how your example, and I can follow that example. And increasingly, I'm sure that there's a place where you see one of the temptations we have in church is we all want to jump to phase two of God's plan, which is, you know, the glory of God descends and I'm going around telling others to do something that I've never done myself. You see, when it says Jesus came for baptism when the glory of God fell, it already said that he had grown in favor with God and with man. So in other words, in his natural life, he was already exhibiting the signs of God's grace on him. See? So when he now starts to go around and teach others about that, it's not just some sort of brand new message out of the blue. It is actually part of his experience. And I think sometimes what we do as churches, we want to jump straight into here to sit and tell people what to do, to be teachers that have never actually done it. Does that make sense? And so there is this place where he actually wants us to know fruitfulness in the natural. It's not that therefore we can't know supernatural fruitfulness before we've done it all. It's just I'm saying there's a natural sort of flow. And so he puts in this room, there will be different gifts, but the world tells us you haven't got any. So we live in a world, I saw the headline in one of the papers the other day, and it said this is the most underemployed generation that's ever lived. What they mean by that is like, well, there's nothing for people to do. And that's part of the sad, sad context. And so there is something, therefore, to find in this creative way, under the guidance of the Holy Spirit, to find ways of releasing the value that's in us to be shared further. See, the world looks to take value, whereas in actual fact, as believers, we already have value, therefore we've got something to give. So we can release it and give it. And so it's a strange thing. Sometimes it's just the fact that I'm good at listening to people. You say, well, I'm just good at listening to people, but amazingly what the Lord does is he turns it into something that makes you very fruitful. Or, do you know, I'm quite good at making these things, wherever they are. And suddenly the Lord turns it into something that's a real blessing to others. You look at the X Factor and so on, is everybody wants to be a rock star because everyone looks at them and it's kind of like that's what the world values. So I don't feel any value myself. So if I want to feel value, I want to be what the world values. So everybody wants to be the rock star, but actually in the Lord, if you know your value, you're quite happy if you're just the person who makes really nice kind of bath products. Okay, but, I know that's it sounds ridiculous, but it's just because I was talking to someone the other day who's actually in one sense got a really good education, really great, but actually they're saying, but you know what I really like doing? Is I love making, I make these scented different products, and people love them, and I love doing this. You think, well, you see, we have a scale that says one thing is here and the other is here, but that is actually based on the world's way of thinking, which is that somehow you've got to prove yourself and prove your value, whereas the other is just, I am who I am, who God has made me, I enjoy doing this, and I can take what I enjoy doing and I make it valuable to others. And so I take what he has made me to enjoy, and because he values me just for the things I enjoy, there must be a way in which I can take what he's made me to enjoy and add value to you by doing it. And you might look at it and say, in the world's economy, that's so peanuts, it will never change a thing. But the strange thing is that it always has been from those places that the world has changed. It is tiny, tiny little things. Like, I have the story of, there's a guy called George Washington Carver, who I always remember because I just read his story, and then on the Simpsons episode, Bart Simpson gets asked in school, do you know who George Washington Carver was? And he says, the guy that cut up George Washington, which wasn't a great funny joke, it reminded me, I just read his story. He was a black American living in southern states, therefore he had every prejudice going against him. But he was obviously good at science, and he pushed his way through kind of science and learning. But he's often said he revolutionized the economy of the South, because he came up with a whole load of simple techniques to use in crop growing that meant that instead of the dust bowls that you got, because he started the kind of a planned cycle of crop rotation that left nutrients in the soil. But his main contribution was his suggestion that they start growing peanuts. Peanuts didn't do the same damage that the cotton did that they used to grow. And so the whole of the South suddenly got a new economy, just based from a simple idea of we should start growing peanuts instead of cotton. You know, now, this is what I mean is, you know, these simple little things. If you were thinking of a plan to change the world, nobody would have come up with that in Washington. You see, but that's the truth. That's how economies and situations and things get changed. And I don't know whether it will be your invention or somebody else's, but what I do know is that there's something about how God works with us, and we suddenly see our value and we understand ourselves, and then we find a way of just being productive and passing on the value we see in ourselves. And somehow the Spirit gets hold of that and it changes the kind of economy. And because I don't just mean in financial terms, but I mean in quality of life terms of all of those around us. And suddenly we are adding more value than we're taking. We are producing rather than consuming. That makes sense. And so I have a simple little exercise, because I think it's important for us to kind of engage with the Lord. So I'm just going to bring my bag over. Because I think, as I said before, the Lord does speak. He wants to speak to everyone here. And so I just want us to think about that first phase of life. And so in my bag, I've got my own special stack. Some of you will remember these from spring. Of Playmobil people. Okay. So quite a large selection of Playmobil. There's a ginger bearded bloke there, and there's a girl with black hair. So we've got all sorts of different people. So in here you can probably find yourself, or someone that's vaguely like you, someone to be you. Because I want us to just take a little bit of time to engage with the Lord, talk to him. And I've got other props in here as well. Now, what I will say is, when we finish, I'm going to have to put these away quickly, because otherwise I will lose them all to the kids. So we'll have to do that. But there are other things in here. And I'm going to ask you to start, even as I'm talking now, start talking to the Lord about what do you want to talk to me about? What area do you want to talk to me about? Because it may be, as I've been talking about the conflict that we come into. You know, we get born into conflict situations, and they can seem to rob us of the destiny that maybe God had for us. Other times, it's not necessarily the conflict so much as almost the confusion of, well, who am I? Or maybe you know, what is it I love to do? So it may be that there's something you know you enjoy doing. It may be that you're very aware that there was something in your past that kind of really robbed you of something. It was the conflict. And I just want us to find a model that can be us, find some props and so on. I have these sheets of paper. What I suggest you do is you take a sheet of paper, and this is your world stage, you know, all the world's a stage. You put it on the floor in front of you. You find a model that is you. I'll be the snowman. I'm just so cool. You know, you put your snowman in, or whoever you are. And there may be, okay, so I don't, that little black pom-poms here, this is the conflict I grew up in. We start just symbolically, and it's not about modelling in a clever way. It's just we model out the situation that we want to talk to the Lord about. Okay? So we're going to model what it is. And then we're just going to say, okay, Lord, now we'll ask some questions. What are you saying to hear? And I really do believe that as we do this, there'll be people that God gives clarity to. You know, because we are... Yeah, I bet you're wondering what's going on. Okay, look. Just looking, see if I can find you in here. No, brown hair. Okay. There's actually someone who's lost the top of their head. Anyone want to claim that one? And so we're going to model our situations. And just in the, I don't know, maybe we've got a CD or something, just put some light music on while people are doing it. And then I'll pick up the microphone again, and we'll just start asking the Holy Spirit some questions about the things you've modelled. And I just want to ask you to tune your ears into the Lord, because as I was saying last night, is what really changes us on the inside is not knowledge in the head, it's the kind of somehow the way the experience hits us. You know, if you are a baby, you don't understand clever words. You do know when a parent just touches and even look at you. And it's so in many ways you say, well, is this just some sort of technique? Yes, it's a technique, but it helps us to just turn our heart to what is the Lord saying about this. And to expect to experience or feel or know something. And sometimes I've had people who hear whole phrases in their heads. I've had people who've actually kind of heard things, not with their ears, but through their heads. Other times people will just say to me, I don't know, but just something kind of clicked, it just felt. And it's so you're seeing this is kind of, it's not a technique, it's just a part of the dialogue. It's just something we're doing, but we're expecting that the Spirit wants to speak to people. And this morning what I'm saying is there's two things. Is what has been the areas of conflict that sometimes seems to rob our fruitfulness? Or if I think it's not what he wants to talk about, what is it I've got that I know I love that is clearly part of who I am that he wants to make me help share value from, to be fruitful with? And how does that go? So either of those two scenarios is really fine. We're just gonna. So I'll stop talking now, and I'll tip these out on the floor and allow people to come and find themselves in amongst the. So please come and get some. Don't forget, grab some paper. Grab a sheet of paper. Find some props if you want to model your situation. And I will try and stop talking for a bit, and then we'll come back in a minute. Also, just emphasising this, when the things that sometimes the Lord makes people fruitful in are not things that people obviously think of sometimes. So we, you know, the world tells us, well, if you're good at this, you know, you can make money from it. But actually, sometimes what people are good at is just making friends. But actually, the Lord uses that regularly as a way of pushing value out and giving people a sense of value. Things like that, the ability to make friends, to really listen to someone. If I put that into my own context, one of the things I became aware of is that part of the reason I do this, and I suppose I like doing it, is I actually love people's stories. I love hearing people's stories. So strangely, the Lord is using the fact that I just like hearing people's stories with me to kind of actually help people see their own stories and capture the value from it. So I'm just, you know, that isn't something that you'd ever get a GCSE in at school, is being interested in people's stories. But it was true of me, and now I see the Lord actually uses it to spread that sense of value. So, you know, just as you're thinking about it, saying, Lord, what is it that I really like doing? I've got energy to do. See, the difference is we have to get paid to do the things that we haven't got energy to do otherwise. You know, if I haven't got the energy to do it, someone has to pay me to do it. Now, some people are fortunate. They get paid for things they would do anyway. And that's great. But what I'm trying to say is, if you try to think, what is it I'm really good at? It's the thing I've got energy to do. Even if no one paid me to do it, I'd still want to do it. I still like being like this. So as I say, the thing I would do, even if no one paid me, would be to sit around drinking coffee and listening to people's stories. Fantastic. I encourage you, because we're going to start to find the mind of the Lord into our situations. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to turn the music down now, okay? Because increasingly now people have got something. You can keep working on it while I talk. See, what I want you to understand is, you know, it says we are seated with him in heavenly places. Part of the reason I often like doing this modelling is it gives us a perspective that is more like being seated with him in heavenly places. Sometimes we're stuck in a situation and we can only see kind of so far. You know, I'm in the middle of my life. So to see my life like the way the Lord sees it is sometimes hard. But by doing these little models, we can kind of start to be like him, seated in heavenly places, looking down and seeing my life and my circumstances in a different way. And so we're going to start to engage with the Lord and ask him to show us stuff from that position. Show us things from there. Now, the thing I just want to say, I'll just kind of give a bit more instruction while people are still finishing their models and so on, is that faith comes by hearing, we're told. And we've often assumed that faith is believing hard for something. But it's not what the Bible says faith is. So often we kind of, oh, I really want this to happen, so I'm going to believe really hard for it. I'm going to believe really hard for it. And then we find it doesn't happen, because actually faith is not believing hard for something. Faith, it says, comes by hearing. But James then says, and it was completed by his action of Abraham. It says it was finished by his action. And Jesus says, you know, if you have faith like a mustard seed, you'll say to this mountain, be moved, and it will be thrown into the sea. And I think the way that faith works is God speaks, and so we're going to expect for God to speak about this situation, to say something. My expectation around the room is that God should say something to you about this. And when God says something, it gives us an opportunity for faith, because faith comes by hearing what he says. And sometimes we just find there can be a tiny little action that we need to take. He'll say something and it implies just a small thing for us to do. Maybe it only feels like a mustard seed, but when we do the little tiny thing by faith that's like a mustard seed, what we find is it creates a ripple effect that changes far more than the action was worth. See, the way the world does it is by straining really hard and trying really hard. But the way we do it by faith is we hear something from the Lord and it implies something that we just need to do, which we'd say in the natural, what's the point of that? You know, sometimes it's as simple as, you know, I've known people who've done things by faith, like throw away a gift or make a phone call to someone and not ring them up and say, you know, the Lord tells me to forgive and so I'm ringing you to tell you that I really don't like you, but now I'm forgiving you. Yeah. That's, I don't mean things like that. I mean a little phone call that is just simply, sometimes a little way, say, how are you doing? And the person says, yeah, that's fine, I haven't heard from you for a while. It's just that something in the conversation has prompted them to think, I need to just do this by faith. And it's only like a mustard seed, and yet it then has an impact. And suddenly out of that reconnection, that reconnected relationship, something starts to flow. And it wasn't that they did it for that. Because if they did it for that, it wouldn't so much have been this faith action. It's just they did it out of what God said when they're doing something like this. Maybe not with Playmobil, because not everyone has a great big stash of 80 Playmobil. I know I'm unusual in that. But whatever the Lord says, it gives us an opportunity to do something by faith, even if it's small. And so I want to... So I'm just going to... Okay, even if you're still modelling now, I'm just going to say, okay, let's... Let's just all turn our attention to Jesus, see if we can just become aware of him. You know, be aware of him with us. And kind of look at our model. And now what I'd encourage you to do is tell Jesus what it is you've modelled. Start to tell him, this is what I've modelled. Tell him why you thought you'd model what you'd model. Tell him what you actually enjoy doing in what you modelled. Tell him how it makes you feel. It's not that he doesn't know, but he loves us to tell him. Tell him if you can have your way, how this would work out in life. You know, this is what I'd really like. I don't think I can do because I've got family or I've got whatever, or I don't think I can do because society won't let me. I don't think I can do because I've got these responsibilities, but just tell him, this is what I'd love to be able to do. I would love it if I could just find a way of doing this, because the thing is, he is the one who gave you the desires of your heart. And sometimes those desires can get twisted, but fundamentally they came from him. They came from him, even if they've got a bit twisted, and we sometimes know that they need a bit of healing, but still fundamentally he gave us them. He gave us those motivations. And so even if as we go on the journey, he slightly realigns them or heals them, it's still important to acknowledge that they were from him. And that they're part of who he's made us to be. So start to tell him what you'd love to be able to do. Now Jesus, just in the quiet, I just ask that you'd open our ears to hear you. You know, Simon means one who listens, which is ironic because Simon never listened. But one day he did listen, and Jesus says to him, well done, Simon, Bar-Jonah. because flesh and blood didn't reveal this to you, but my Father is in heaven. In other words, for one day he just did what he was always supposed to do, which was to listen. And then Jesus goes and tells him a whole load of things about himself, about Simon. He says, I'm telling you now, you'll be called Peter. He speaks into him. So Jesus, open our ears so we're ready to hear you now. Father, just tell us, Jesus, tell us something about the situation we're looking at. Give us the word. What is this? What, is there something we could do in this? Is there something I need? Sometimes I know I could do something, but I'm too fearful to try it. Perhaps he wants to speak a word of encouragement to you. Perhaps he wants to speak a word of wisdom or a word of timing. Perhaps he wants to say something to you about the situation which will just change the way you even see it in a way that's positive. What do you want to say, Jesus? Now, Jesus, we just offer our hopes to you as prayers. Father, you know, you say that faith is the assurance of the things we hope for. And in some way or other, as we've modelled these things that we love to do, the things that we love to be, who we are in you, there's a hope in them. There's a hope that we could really see this come out as being strongly part of us. That doesn't mean to say that everything we do in life is the same thing. You know, someone has to kind of keep the books sometimes. You know, you may enjoy kind of being a musician and playing the gigs, but someone still has to keep the accounts. So, but fundamentally, we find that actually life has that thread in it that makes sense of who we are. That allows the gifts that God has put into us when we were knit together in the womb, when he fearfully and wonderfully made us, when he made us to be good organizers of people, when he made us to be good carers of people, when he made us to be enthusiastic in our arts and our crafts, when he made us to be teachers of others, when he made us to be encouragers of others, all of those things that he made us to be, that we love and that we enjoy doing. Lord Jesus, we offer them to you as a prayer with hope. And faith is the assurance of the things we hope for. I just ask that by your Spirit you would assure us that you have our best interests at heart. You have our best plans in your plan. You have all of your best intentions match up with who you've made us to be. In Jesus' name.